Michael Picardi here with the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Monday, August 26. Today, in depth on how law enforcement deals with people who are intoxicated, the human feeding of wolves in the wild, and hawking goods at the state fair, not as lucrative as you might think. First, the heat. The hot, humid weather is expected to continue this week. There is an excessive heat warning for the southern third of the state through tomorrow evening, and emergency room physicians expect to see an increase in patients with heat-related illnesses. Here's Lorna Benson.
Children under age 5 and elderly people are among those most vulnerable to heat-related stress. But anyone can succumb to excessive heat, especially if they don't have access to air conditioning or if they're participating in strenuous outdoor activities. Casey Worcester is an emergency department physician at Regents Hospital in St. Paul. He says even people who are relaxing can overheat if they drink the wrong beverages.
So just remembering that beer and alcohol and soda can actually lead to dehydration. So if it's hot out and you're outside, more important to drink water and Gatorade and things like that that are less sugary or containing alcohol.
Worcester says feeling lightheaded, confused, or not sweating can be signs of heat-related illnesses or heat stroke. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That heat is especially tough on the students and staff of the Minneapolis School District back in session today. 18 Minneapolis school buildings have no air conditioning. Funeral services take place today for Hussein Samatar. He was a Minneapolis school board member and the first Somali American elected to public office in Minnesota. Samatar died yesterday from complications of leukemia at the age of 45. Zuhair Ahmed is one of many young Somali leaders in the Twin Cities who was mentored by Samatar.
Hussein kind of believed in, we're here now, let's focus here, let's build ourselves, let's build the community here, let's pay attention to the youth here, make sure that they get a good education, and then when you build yourself from kind of bottom up over here, you'll be able to give back to those folks back home.
Samatar had considered running for Minneapolis mayor before he was diagnosed with leukemia last December. He was among the first wave of Somali refugees from the Civil War to settle in the U.S. in the early 1990s. The Minnesota Department of Education releases the latest round of student assessment test scores tomorrow. Tim Post reports.
Results of the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Tests, or MCAs, are one measure of how well students, as well as their schools and teachers, are performing. The State Department of Education has warned parents to expect a dip in reading scores this year because it's the first time students were tested on more stringent national standards. Charlene Briner is the department's chief of staff.
We've set very high expectations for students in order to fully prepare them for college and career. And now they're taking tests that are aligned to those new standards.
Briner says this year's reading scores shouldn't be directly compared to last year's because of the change in standards. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Democratic Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez drew a crowd of hundreds of Minnesota Latinos at an appearance in South Minneapolis yesterday. Rupa Shenoy was there.
Gutierrez was hosted by Congressman Keith Ellison, who called him one of the faces of the immigration reform movement. Ellison said he hoped Gutierrez's appearance would galvanize the local Latino community. People spoke to Gutierrez mainly about putting an end to deportations so they wouldn't lose a family member. Gutierrez said he understands that should be a priority over establishing a path to citizenship. He said people need to have faith that change is possible.
People have to organize in Minnesota. Keith and I are going to vote for comprehensive immigration reform. But a lot of people get discouraged, and today gives them hope, and you have to inform them.
Gutierrez said he believes Republicans will vote for bipartisan immigration legislation. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
An ethanol plant near the Minnesota-Iowa border should begin making ethanol from discarded parts of corn crops in a few months. Here's our Mark Stile.
Minnesota farmers will be among those dumping off corn cobs, leaves, and husks at Poet DSM's plant in Emmitsburg, Iowa. It could be the first plant in the nation producing ethanol on a commercial scale from anything other than actual grain. A second so-called cellulosic ethanol facility in Kansas is expected to open at about the same time. Poets Steve Hartig says the Iowa plant has started to hire managerial staff.
Middle of construction now, and we'll be starting the plant up in the first quarter of next year.
Hartig says at peak capacity, the plant will make about 25 million gallons of ethanol a year. It's being built next to an existing Poet ethanol plant in Emmitsburg that makes the biofuel from corn kernels. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State and federal officials are concerned some severely intoxicated people may not be getting the care they need to sober up. Detoxification admissions are declining as facilities around the state close, but law enforcement officials and others say the number of people who need to go to detox is not falling. Mark Zedeklik has a look.
It's Derby night at the Pine County Fair, and Sheriff Robin Cole says that means there will be a lot of partying.
Beer garden is open, and that'll be open till 1 o'clock in the morning.
About 2,000 people are expected, and the sheriff says his deputies will probably end up driving some of them home.
We deal with the same things that they do in the city. We just have to be a little more creative in how we take care of it.
Consuming too much alcohol to legally drive is one thing. To be falling down dangerously drunk is another. Helping those people is a growing problem in many places around Minnesota.
When someone is intoxicated, they can't take care of themselves, then it's up to us to take care of them. We just don't have any place to bring them, and that's our biggest problem.
That's because the detox center that Pine County contracts with is in Duluth. That's as much as 2 hours away from some parts of the county. Driving that far cuts significantly into a deputy's shift. Cole says they make the trip, but only if they have to. They look for other options, like finding a relative or a friend, or dropping the person at a hospital. And there is a last resort.
I hate to say it, but, you know, jail is always the other option we have.
Being publicly intoxicated is not a crime in Minnesota. But Sheriff Cole says drunk people in public often violate laws, so they can be legally incarcerated. But Cole doesn't think it's right that they should be.
You know, if you find somebody that's laying in the street, passed out, do they need to go to detox or do they need to go to jail for blocking traffic? And I guess that's the question. They don't need to go to jail. They need to go to detox. They're having a medical issue.
But in many areas of Minnesota, ready access to detox is no longer an option. Cole says not having a detox center close at hand creates serious liability concerns for departments like his.
I certainly would not want to get a call in the middle of the night that a person that should have gone to a detoxification facility or a medical facility was brought into the jail and then died in the jail because they were so intoxicated and weren't cared for properly.
According to an internal Minnesota Department of Human Services report obtained by NPR News, about a third of detox facilities in Minnesota have closed over the past decade. The same report chronicles a more than 20% decrease in detox admissions from 2001 to 2011. The report concludes there's no reason to believe fewer people are using alcohol and drugs.
My name is Corky McQuiston, and I'm the police chief in Brainerd.
Brainerd is where the detox center in Crow Wing County was located until it closed in the spring of 2011. Like Sheriff Cole in Pine County, Chief McQuiston wishes a detox were closer. His department, too, has to put law enforcement work on hold to spend time tracking down detox space within a couple of hours' drive. Brainerd police also look for alternatives for drunk people that they wouldn't pursue if they had a detox in town.
I think what it boils down to is the people aren't getting the services that they need as quickly as they should be, or, you know, probably in some limited situations that they're not getting the appropriate care that they should get.
Our department has been looking at this for quite some time now.
Dave Hartford is the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Hartford says the lack of detox facilities is a significant issue in Minnesota.
Many counties have been caught between how do they provide that service, because there are no services readily available in their counties.
Federal officials are also concerned about the way potentially dangerously intoxicated Minnesotans are being cared for. Dr. Wesley Clark directs the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. His office is in the middle of a review of detox services in Minnesota that will soon propose changes.
both we and the state agreed that the state should receive technical assistance to help it determine the extent to which the level of detox in different regions of the state is consistent with the need. So we know that there is clearly a need.
The state-federal review is scheduled to be completed by the end of August. From there, state and federal officials will try to come up with new ways of providing detox services throughout the state. Dave Hartford from the State Human Services Department says one option under consideration is to cover detox through Medicaid. That would relieve counties of the burden of paying for detox.
Detox services could be made a Medicaid benefit so that it could be reimbursed as health care. And that's the direction that we're heading.
Hartford says officials are also looking at defining new levels of detoxification services, and they're looking at tapping technology to help providers in remote places.
You may have a safe housing situation that's not medically monitored by nursing staff, that you may have what's referred to as sobering centers, having physicians or other staff on a consulting basis. There's multiple designs that could be done.
Gary Olson is the head of the Duluth Detox Center and has been working with detox programs in northeastern Minnesota since the 1970s. He thinks if the state takes away the responsibility of paying for detox from counties, state officials are likely to take a shortage of detox facilities more seriously.
I'm pleased that they're looking at it and they're concerned about it. I think we have unique challenges in Minnesota, but frankly, it hasn't really been a high priority for the state. I think, and I guess this is my own opinion, but I think it's because the state doesn't fund it. And when the state doesn't fund it, they have less incentive to really take a look at how the system is operating and trying to figure out how we can make it work better.
Department of Human Services officials say they hope to have a detox proposal ready for consideration in time for the 2014 legislative session.
Mark Zedeklik there. Don't feed the wildlife is a message frequently trumpeted at campgrounds around Minnesota. It's usually meant to warn people not to feed deer or bears. But this summer, wildlife managers are expanding that message to wolves. In at least two locations in northeastern Minnesota, people are feeding wolf pups. And as Dan Crocker reports, officials say those easy meals could have very negative consequences.
Gary Heppala pulls his pickup out of the parking lot of Hugo's, the bar and general store he runs with his wife in the tiny town of Brimson, about 40 miles north of Duluth. It doesn't take long to see a wolf pup.
You'll notice they have no fear here. They'll come right up to that window.
Sure enough, the young wolf with pointy ears and splotches of gray, white, and tan fur ambles right up to Heppala's open window.
What are you doing? Get off the road.
Heppala says the wolves have grown steadily bolder over the past 6 weeks or so. He says he's seen people place piles of food on the side of the road to lure the wolves in close to snap pictures.
I've chewed a few people out. So don't be feeding the wolves. People don't realize, they're going to become adults. They're cute now. Not so cute when they're big.
But Heppala fears that some of these pups might not even make it to adulthood. One of the eight was killed by a car last week. Nancy Hansen, DNR Assistant Area Wildlife Manager in Two Harbors, says that number could grow.
They are at a very busy intersection. It's going to get busier with hunting seasons coming up. So I'm concerned.
Hansen says the wolf pups are using a stretch of forest near the intersection of two county highways as a rendezvous site. The adults in the pack leave the pups to hunt and then bring food back to them. Wildlife experts say people sometimes see wolf pups alone, maybe think they look thin, and assume they've been abandoned and need food. Hansen says the DNR is trying to educate the public otherwise.
Basically, we really need people to police themselves. As neat as it is to see these animals, this is not a normal situation, and anything they're doing to, get a picture taken with a wolf pup or feed a wolf pup, it's not good for the pups.
Hansen says they can't relocate the pups because they'd either die away from the pack or just return to the rendezvous point.
If we can't turn it around, we'll probably have to capture these pups, and they'll either have to be moved to a facility or destroyed.
Hansen says she's never seen a situation like the Hugo's wolves, as she refers to them. She says news of the wolves has spread like wildfire on Facebook, and more people are flocking to see them. Jess Edberg, Information Services Director at the International Wolf Center in Ely, says she's dealing with a similar situation on the Echo Trail near the Boundary Waters canoe area.
So the wolf pups are hanging on the road, sitting on the road, watching vehicles go by, and then somebody did see that there was fresh food put out there.
Edberg says every year or two she hears of emboldened wolves not fleeing from passing cars. In those situations, she says it's not enough to just not feed them. She says even a passive observer can encourage wolves to frequent an area.
We want to make sure that wildlife have a healthy fear avoidance of humans. So honking your horn or yelling, you know, not encouraging the animal to be there is going to be helpful for the survival of that animal.
Back at Hugo's Bar in Brimson, owner Jody Heppola says the wolves have become something of a tourist attraction.
The store's been busy. Lots of people come in to comment and get a snack while they're out looking for the wolves, and lots of phone calls asking, are there really wolves up there, and, you know, what time of day, and where can we see you?
But Heppola says she'd gladly give up the increased business. She wants the wolves to learn to fend for themselves. As I drive out of Brimson, two wolf pups trot straight at my car, right down the yellow dotted line in the center of the county highway. They approach my open window as I slow down. It's something Gary Heppola experiences nearly every day. As he puts it, it's fun and exciting to see a wolf so close, but also disconcerting to see wolves so comfortable around him.
Dan Crocker in Brimson. It's day five of the State Fair. The fair draws nearly 2 million people every summer to Falcon Heights, and that foot traffic makes it a choice location for nearly 800 businesses, hawking everything from corn dogs to tractors. But as Martin Moylan reports, profits don't come easily at the fair.
John Mancini runs one of the most popular restaurants in the Twin Cities, Mancini's Char House. But he waited more than a decade for an opening to set up shop at the State Fair. He got his wish this year when he was offered a spot here on Carnes Avenue.
I always, as a kid, wanted to work out here, wanted to run something, and I guess the dream is coming now. We're a destination now. We hope for years to come.
Mancini and his brother Pat have spent a lot of money, they won't say how much, on stonework, stainless steel appliances, and other things to renovate their space at the fair. The offerings include steak sandwiches, garlic toast, and other popular items from Mancini's menu. And music. The Carnes Avenue site will be in operation only during the fair and maybe a few other events. Mancini hopes he'll win new customers to his restaurant in St. Paul. But will the fair be a moneymaker?
Well, I'll let you know Labor Day.
But Mancini says he saw more opportunity at the fair than just the chance to boost sales.
Have fun, nostalgia. Mancini's got a lot of history. The fair's got a lot of history. It's a good combination.
But it's not a combination anyone can live off for the rest of the year. Dennis Larson oversees food and beverage vendors at the fair. He says there's a myth about how lucrative the fair businesses are.
You get a food booth at the fair, you spend the rest of the year counting your money and waiting for the next fair, and that's just really not true.
Vendors have to pay a hefty rent to the fair, and then Larson notes there are labor, supply, and other costs, as well as taxes.
The reality is a typical or a median booth here will do about $55,000 gross in sales. But that's gross. Nobody has that money. They have to pay sales tax. They have to pay us our 15%. A good operator could probably bring home maybe 25% of that. So he's going to make a few thousand dollars, there's no doubt about it. But still, you're not going to live on that.
Larson says most vendors have other jobs or travel the State Fair circuit around the country. Or they're retired like Patty Peterson and her husband Mike and see the fair as a chance to make some money on the side. The Peterson's restaurant, Peterson's Pork Chops, opens for the fair and a car show at the fairgrounds. Patty Peterson says that's it for the year, but they do come out ahead.
We come out in the black. Our daughter's like in her seventh year of college, so it's been helping pay for that. Helps pay for our fun a little bit.
Each August, the Petersons have to get the big trailer that houses their restaurant to the fair and set it up. And they have to recruit about 40 workers to cook and serve chops and chicken.
It's not as easy as you think.
How does she describe work days that start at about 6 in the morning and end about 1 the next morning?
12 days of hell.
Even so, the Petersons say they really do enjoy the fair, but the money isn't good enough for them to bust their chops at other fairs.
We tried other venues when we first started back in the early 90s. It's a lot of work for little profit.
Most vendors, though, do go from fair to fair around the country for a living. 55-year-old musician Don Thomas from Western New York hits dozens of fairs and fine art shows from Maine to Florida. This is his first year at the Minnesota Fair, where he'll play guitar and sell CDs of his music.
We've got on the fair circuit about 5 years ago. Fairs is a new thing to us, but we're bringing peaceful music, all original, all classical and acoustic guitar instrumentals.
Few vendors have been at the fair as long as Steichen's Grocery Store and Deli down an alley near the poultry barn. The shop first opened for the 1933 fair. Jimmy Steichen now runs it. He says he's pretty much the only source at the fair for things like aspirin and jugs of milk. As for business this year...
It's okay. You know, we sell a lot of low-priced items, so you're not going to come in here and spend a lot of money.
He's not getting rich on fair business, but Steichen opens up every year anyway. Perhaps not so much for the money, but more for the tradition and history, like so many Minnesotans.
Martin Moylan at the State Fair. Also there, Peter Moe. He's the Director of Operations and Research at the U of M's Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. Moe knows apples. The world-renowned breeding program at the university is responsible for classic apples, such as Harrelson's and Beacon's, as well as modern varieties like Honeycrisp, Zestar, and Sweet Tango. In fact, 80% of the apples grown in Minnesota were developed by the University of Minnesota. Inside the horticulture building, Peter Moe gave producer Jim Bickle a lesson in apple making.
Well, it's a traditional breeding program. There's no genetic engineering. We really take the role of the bees. And so we might take two apples, maybe a Harrelson because it's very hardy and it's got real juicy fruit and a lot of tart flavor, and maybe cross that with a sweet apple like Honeygold, which doesn't have the texture but has the sweet flavor. And then you do the cross, and apples are very heterozygous, which means that the genes from both parents are mixed, and there's a lot of hidden genes that aren't expressed in either one of the parents that show up in the seedlings. And so we grow thousands of seedlings, and you really don't know what you've got until those seedlings are big enough to have a fruit. And then one of our scientists, Dave Bedford, goes out, he's the same one that does the crosses, goes up and down the rows of seedling blocks in the fall and tastes apples one after another, and really just takes a bite. And he knows he's looking for texture, he's looking for flavor, he's looking for the appearance of the apple too, but texture and flavor are certainly the big characteristics.
So how many sort of types of experimental apple breeds would you sort of have going at any one time?
Thousands. We probably have 8,000 or 10,000 apple seedlings growing right now. And out of that bunch, only two or three will probably get introduced.
Any ones that are particularly terrible experiments that have tasted bad?
Actually, most of the seedling apples do taste bad. But the way that Minnesota developed hardy apples was getting Russian germplasm, and so they would use crab apples from Russia and things grown in Canada that were only grown because they were hardy but not very good quality. And a lot of those genes are still in the fruits, and so they show up. A lot of the apples are small. Some are bitter. Some are sour. Some are just so sweet that they don't taste good. And so we're looking for the balance, you know, sweet and tart. The texture is really the U of M trademark.
Has this made a lot of money for the university?
It has. The Honeycrisp is no longer under plant patent, but during the 17 years it was under plant patent, it brought about $8 million back to the university. And now that there's no additional income in the U.S. because of the patents expired, but the growers that are being licensed around the world are paying royalties back to the University of Minnesota.
How is climate change potentially going to affect the growing of apples here?
Well, the biggest effect in climate change has had for us is not so much the temperatures, but the rainfall patterns have been really strange. And really, apples are a huge amount of water. And so with the last 2 years, we haven't had any rain in August and September. That affects fruit size. It can affect fruit flavor. And so we really need just regular rainfall during the season. Of course, all farmers are always looking for that, but it's really important for apples.
I like the Honeycrisps as well. I've noticed they're kind of expensive. Why is that?
Yeah, that's really a supply and demand. They're not an easy apple to grow. And so you've got to be a really, really knowledgeable and experienced apple grower to grow Honeycrisp successfully.
That's Peter Moe with the U's Landscape Arboretum. He was interviewed by producer Jim Bickle. That's it for the Monday NPR News Update. Thanks for stopping in. Phil Picardi with you again with audio on demand tomorrow.